Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for the 17th day of April. Very nice to have you with us. It is a Wednesday morning, 15 minutes past 9 o'clock, and hello all. I hope you are well and keeping well on what appears, at least in this region, to be a pretty beautiful day. So we'll keep to that and and hope after that things are, you know, there'll be that we can enjoy the day and the weather. Wouldn't that be nice? We have a great group this morning. Let me introduce everybody to you, and we will get started. We always welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We welcome to the proceedings former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm great. Happy to be here.
Really good to have you with us. We welcome the Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, Joe. You know what else is happening right now?
Another.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Now,
the hummingbirds have been sighted in New Jersey, so they're coming. So everybody who is a hummingbird fanatic, like my wife and I, get your feeders ready.
Yeah, well, I mean, that shouldn't, they're small and fast. It shouldn't take them long to get up here.
I don't think they stop to gamble anymore, so.
No. And they got the new rest areas.
Right.
Yeah. It'll all be fine.
As long as they're not trying to travel on Sundays. Yeah.
Great. We welcome Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning. I had a very exciting night at Siena last night. We had a group of women leaders from the League of Women Voters Albany chapter on campus. They worked with our students in educating them on the work of the League of Women Voters, the history of it, and then our students worked with them on creating some posters and Instagram postings and other social media outreach to educate young voters about what to watch out for, what to pay attention to, how to distinguish between misinformation, disinformation, and trustworthy information. So we've been having a lot of fun with the League, and they're coming back next week to register some voters on our campus. So we are in a major registration effort to make our campus a voter-friendly campus.
We also welcome, that sounds very cool.
Doesn't it? I was like, did I go too long?
No. That all sounds really great, and thank you very much. I should mention, Vera also is going to be a part of our panel on Friday, which is an exceptional group of women panelists. And if you're free, join us. It's going to be terrific. That is Friday morning from 9 to 11, and there are tickets available. It's a contribution to the station, and you can find it at WAMC.org and just go online for a donation, and you'll see it in the drop-down menu, or you can just give us a call, 1-800-323-9262, and get your tickets that way. So it should be an awful lot of fun. We are greatly honored to have the mayor of the city of Albany, New York, Kathy Sheehan, with us this morning. Mayor, good morning. So good to have you with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I know it's been a rough evening for you, and you are, I don't think you have gotten any sleep, right?
No.
An Albany police officer was shot and wounded and a suspect killed early this morning after a traffic stop in the Pine Hills neighborhood just after midnight. Albany police officer was wounded. The suspect died, and it was an ambush during a traffic stop. And you are quoted in the Times Union as saying it was an act of depraved gun violence. What are you able to tell us?
Well, first of all, it looks like the officer is going to be okay. He is having some surgery. I'm not going to go into any more detail than that, but I was able to speak with him. His family was with him. And, you know, so we're very grateful for that. And, you know, this was a situation where we say a traffic stop, but as the chief explained, the police officer saw a vehicle speeding potentially as fast as, you know, 80 miles an hour, very, very fast speed in the city and on Western Avenue. And the officer started a pursuit but then called it off because it was unsafe. And it was later when he was patrolling that he saw the vehicle parked on the road and pulled up and got out of his car to go and look at the vehicle, didn't know if anyone was in it. And in fact, the suspect was behind the vehicle. He was not in it. He was behind the vehicle and he came out from behind the vehicle and immediately started shooting at the officer. So pretty horrific. We will be holding another press conference later today. The chief does want to release the body-worn camera video so that people can see what happens, and we think that's important in creating trust and making sure that we're being transparent.
Firing two shots when he came out of the vehicle and wounding the officer in the leg, and then the officer returned fire, and that is when the suspect was killed. As far as your quote of an act of depraved gun violence, unfortunately, that is not a rare phrase to be used here and in cities across this country.
Well, look, again, I swore to uphold the Constitution, and I uphold the Second Amendment, but this is yet another example of an individual that never should have had a firearm, you know, given the acts that he engaged in with that firearm. I think about my friend Mayor Walsh in Syracuse, who sadly is going to have to bury an officer. Again, an instance where an individual who should not have a gun had a gun. I think that the Albany Police Department does an outstanding job of getting red flag orders. I don't know enough about this suspect to say anything at this point in time, but there are indications that this may have been an individual who had significant challenges. And, you know, we have to ensure that our public is safe, our police officers are safe. And for those who are fighting red flag laws and saying that judges should not be able to prohibit somebody from having a gun, clearly do not, in my view, do not stand for law enforcement. They don't stand for our police officers. They are the ones who are literally in the line of fire. And we have to come and have a reckoning with respect to how we treat guns in this country, because this doesn't happen in other places.
How optimistic are you that it can happen either here in New York or, well, let's stick with New York.
Well, look, I think that New York is one of the states that does have pretty strict gun laws. And when you look at the data, the per capita per capita, we're one of the lowest with respect to shootings. I mean, every shooting is tragic, though. So every shooting, there's a story behind that and a family and a person that's impacted. But our per capita shootings are much lower than states that have far more liberal gun laws. The challenge is that these guns make their way into our state. And, most of the guns that come here that we find that are illegal are from out of state. And, you know, again, if people want to own a firearm because they feel they need it for protection or they want to hunt, you know, I have no issue with that. But at what point do we not step back and say, how is this working for us? More guns is not making us safer.
Bob?
Well, I just think it's an interesting observation that the Supreme Court says that abortion should be a state rights issue and pushes reproductive freedom back to the states, but continually undermines states like New York and California when it comes to just basic common sense gun rights. And, you know, Joe, we've talked about it on the show before, but when did the Second Amendment become the primary Bill of Rights legislation? When did the rest of us give up our rights to safety and security because of the gun lobby?
Well, it's been pretty much documented that the NRA began a campaign that change the way that people look at the ownership of firearms and change public opinion and use scare tactics and a lot of money to influence legislation, et cetera, et cetera. But and they have very effectively stopped measures that would limit the availability of guns, especially to people who may be challenged and may not be responsible for how they behave. And they have very effectively, they got rid of the assault weapons ban.
Yeah.
The assault weapons ban in the 90s, there was a measurable decrease. When Congress passed a ban on the sale of assault weapons in the 90s, it was only for 10 years. It had to be re-upped. And the NRA stopped that very effectively. They put the word out to legislators, you're in trouble, you'll get on our bad list if you support renewing this bill. But there was a measurable decline in serious violence and attacks during that time. And we know the solution. We just don't have policy.
And Mike, at the same time, the leadership of the NRA was lining their pockets.
Oh, yes.
And they were lining the politicians' pockets. Mm-hmm. And you just see the symbiotic relationship of corruption between leadership in the NRA, the GOP, and the Supreme Court.
And the manufacturers of firearms.
So I was going to say I'm slightly optimistic because we see the NRA imploding. You know, in terms of the leadership and the corruption financially, we see now the initial court cases against parents and purchasing guns for minors in the Michigan shooting case. And we now see, I think, public awareness and the consideration of suing gun manufacturers when they're not tracing potentially the sales or the distribution. I mean, we are, I think, shifting a little bit in terms of public opinion on this, because I think those that are responsible gun owners are beginning to think more about and have conversations about storing guns safely. And I think the conversations have shifted in my experience with it in the last few years. I don't know if you also feel that there has been some shift, or do you think it's the same?
I mean, I think we're still seeing, though, incredible carnage.
Yes,
and,
we do.
You know, we have two children this year who were able to get a hold of firearms that were not secured and were not locked.
Yep.
You know, one died and the other was injured. And and so, you know, this idea of owning a gun, I think that you go back to the manufacturers. This is about money.
Yes, it is.
This is about profits and money and scaring people into arming themselves.
Yep.
And more guns have not made us safer. And it's just a fact. Mm-hmm. So people can send emails and scream and rant at me, but the fact is more guns has not made us safer.
One of the things I always think about is how we changed our positions on seat belts, and we forced insurance companies to pursue regulation in coordination. So it is about money at the center. Mm-hmm. And if we do something in relation to making it costly at some point for gun owners to not properly store, not properly handle, not purchase legally, and so on. If we make it costly, then people will change their behaviors.
I mean,
right?
I'm for the liability insurance plan. You know, some people think gun owners need to buy liability insurance just like a car owner needs to.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree.
Seems to make sense. Well, it's certainly a tragic incident to have taken place, and one that is far too common.
Well, another thing that I did say, and if people missed it, is if you see a police officer today, thank them for their service.
Absolutely.
No matter what community you're in, because they're feeling this, and they feel this every time this happens, and it is with gratitude that I sit here, because we have incredible officers who are out there every day, and they are putting themselves in harm's way.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other stories. And we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Mike Spain, Vicarious Kelly, Bob Griffin, and Mayor Kathy Sheehan. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Vera Acarius Kelly, Bob Griffin, Mike Spain, and the mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan. A lousy night last night for the city and for the mayor. However, because all I wanted to talk to you about was you posted a picture of you from Monday night with Bruce Springsteen. And, man, you both look happy.
It was such a phenomenal show. I mean, from beginning to end, he was amazing. The band was amazing. The energy was amazing. But the crowd was on their feet, having a great time.
The entire time.
I mean, I'm 60, and... You know, I had to sit down a few times. I don't know how.
I did. I was like, here he's up there nuts, and I can't. I'm winded.
He never took a break.
No.
You know.
No.
So it was just that energy and the energy in that in the MVP arena. It was just so phenomenal, and to be able to go backstage and thank him for coming and tell him how important it is to have something like this that brings people together, and it was a celebration. Mm-hmm. And you know, he said to me in all sincerity, he said, "I love Albany. This is the best crowd we've had in the United States."
Yeah.
And he could not say enough things about how great the crowd was. And how much fun it was. So, I think when you see a performer up there, you sometimes think, are they just kind of, going through the motions? And he was all in, and we all felt it, and he felt it back. And so it was a great, great moment for Albany.
There was a moment, I think, during the encores where I was right behind the standing room section. So not on the floor, but right behind the standing room, the general admission, the pit, as it were. And there's a point where, this is where the barrage of hits is coming. Mm. And the whole place is just nuts. Mm. I just noticed, myself included, everybody was just looking around and sort of taking in that scene of the arena completely filled, not an empty seat, and just all standing, and it was really something. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, very similar to the feeling I had when I was there just 2 weeks ago for the
Iowa game.
I mean, it was so cool. And to say there's nothing to do in Albany, well, okay, what about this? I mean, this is pretty good.
Yeah, one American icon a couple weeks ago, another American icon
this week. It's pretty great. And this is the third time I saw him there, and mm-hmm. I agree with you. I thought, I've never seen a more electric, amazing, crowd-friendly show than that.
Yeah, I think that it was something that we really needed, and I think, hearkening back to 2 weeks ago, everybody had such a great time at the NCAA tournament, mm-hmm. and we were so proud of the show that we put on and the hospitality that our hotels, our restaurants, everybody worked their butts off, and it showed. And so, to have people come to Albany's defense and say, wait a minute, what are you talking about? I think I was reading an article about, there's a vibe session, like people are just we're not in a recession, but we're like, people have, where's the vibe,
yeah.
right?
Vibe.
And so I felt like, wow, like the vibe here is really good. And, you think about what we're doing, and we just got to build on it and build on it. And yes, bad things happen, right?
Yep.
And they've always happened. There's nothing new about it. We've always had challenges and wars and bad things that happen. It's how we respond as a community. And boy, that Monday night will go down in my memory as one of those great nights where a community really felt like they came together.
And I think at our age, Mayor, if you feel any kind of vibe, that's pretty good. I'm happy.
What?
I'm happy about that. I will say, to the point, I stayed because I did. He's Bruce Springsteen's famous for going like 3 hours, just right. you know. Mm-hmm. So and I didn't know when, so I got a hotel down in the city to stay over, so I didn't have to drive home. And everybody in the hotel, I think hotels were sold out. You couldn't find a hotel in Albany. And everybody that was there was going to the show. And everyone was so excited. And people were traveling from, I mean, there was a group there from Chicago. That it was like the one weekend of the show that they wanted to go to, and a lot of people from across the state and from the city, and it's a really cool thing to be able to do. So congratulations for working on it with the arena, and of course, and thanks to Mr. Springsteen for putting in quite a show. All right, and if you get a chance, go to Kathy's Instagram because it's a great picture. It's a really, really fun picture, and you, I assume you had good seats.
We did. I was, kind of up.
The picture you took? Is that from your seat?
Yes. I'm zooming in a bit, but yeah.
That's still good.
It was great.
Well, good. I'm.
And of course, you know, had the tickets for a year plus.
Well, that's right.
They were dated, right? I think, March 23rd or something like that.
Yes, they were. That's right. He canceled twice, and this was the third time. So
the third was a charm.
Pretty wonderful.
Thank you, Bruce.
All right, a couple of letters on the shooting and some of the statements that were mentioned earlier, and then we'll go to other stuff here. I'm waiting for my computer to allow me to access the letters. So if any of you have any stories about your children or grandchildren, please feel free to utilize this moment as my...
If I could, Joe, you know, I think the stories about Springsteen and the events in Albany and the NCAA are really important because it counters the narrative that we're going to hear a lot about the decay and apocalyptic nature of cities, particularly in blue states, that we're hearing from Trump and the maggots, that... I think just is just flat out wrong, and the ability to remind people how vibrant our cities are, and how important the cities are to our arts and communities, and actually holding the country together is something that I certainly hope that Biden and the Democrats do a better job in combating this cycle than last. Mm-hmm.
Megan writes, big shout out to Mayor Sheehan. Cheered along with her at the Sweet 16 in Albany. Big fan of women's basketball. Hello from the girls who sat behind you. Whoop, whoop. Megan. Very cool.
Hi. You guys were a lot of fun.
You know, I realize this is going to be sexist, and I apologize for being sexist. But I went to the men's tournament last year, and I went to the women's tournament this year. The men's tournament was barbaric. I mean, it's lovely, but people just get it's a lot of chugging and whooping and people, you know, grunting and the women's tournament is just lovely. It's just families and kids and people who are so excited about the game. It was really great. That's not to say anything against it. I had a great time at the men's too, but it's a different, as you would say, vibe. Yes. Okay.
Fair enough.
Oliver, Mayor Kathy Sheehan, quickly releasing police body camera footage is laudable, but only if it happens with equal speed, whether it exonerates or implicates police. Too often we see unfit officers protected by slow walking or denying the public's right to footage and other information. What are your views in this regard? And I assume... You get the shrapnel, as it were, from other departments across the country who may slow walk it.
Well, I think, you know, sometimes it is very specific to what the circumstances are. You know, one of the things for me is making sure that the family of the officer or the perpetrator have the opportunity to see the video first, and not be surprised by it if they so choose to do that. And so, but I do think that, for me, you know, there's a police chief who advises the U.S. Conference of Mayors who says, you know, bad news does not get better with age. And so I think it's really important from an accountability standpoint to move as quickly as the circumstances warrant. And I think typically the circumstances warrant being as transparent as possible. And so, you know, sometimes if it's an incident that involves multiple officers, you're talking about what can add up to, you know, hours of body cam footage that you have to review. And so I also think that that is a factor. In this situation, it's just the body cam footage of the officer involved so we can move more rapidly. In other incidents, oftentimes you have multiple vantage points and multiple things that you have to look at. But I agree. It's important to move as quickly as possible and be transparent.
We also go to this letter from John. I'm sure that any regulation to force compulsory insurance on gun ownership will be shot down, pun intended, due to not allowing unfettered possession. Then we go, and right before we go to break, we go to Lars, who said, been to hundreds of concerts and managed a touring band. Born in the USA tour at Giants Stadium was a life-changing experience for me. Yay to Bruce. Yay to Albany. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll start talking about, it's 9:45. Do you know where your former president is? Not court today, right?
No.
Tomorrow. No, I think Wednesdays are off.
Yeah, right? Wednesdays are off. Tomorrow, back in court. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about jurors. We'll talk about the process and much more. We welcome your letters. First News. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. You can write to us, panel at WAMC.org. Yesterday, we were talking about jury selection in Donald Trump's trial, and we mentioned that no jurors were chosen in the first day of jury selection. That changed yesterday. 7 jurors picked in the trial. As the judge presses ahead, the judge overseeing Donald Trump's criminal trial said opening statements could begin as soon as Monday, as the jury selection process sped up and Trump got an earful from the people who might soon decide his fate. Lawyers for Trump on Tuesday repeatedly argued that old social media posts by many of the prospective jurors or their friends showed that they were not being forthcoming about their animosity toward him, while prosecutors argue that old dumb jokes on the internet were not a cause to dismiss someone from the panel. Trump, the likely Republican nominee for president in the November election, spent hours listening as potential jurors offered their opinions of him, some blunt, some guarded, and some just outright funny. By the end of the day, 7 people had been sworn in as jurors, more than a third of the total number of people that will be needed to hold a trial with a full jury and 6 alternates. And it's a big change from 24 hours ago, where many court watchers were saying that it could be weeks for a jury to be seated. If New York Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan can stick to this pace, the first criminal trial of a former president will be fully underway in less than a week, a potential turning point for Trump's campaign to return to the White House. Trump is charged with 34 counts of falsifying business records. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg says Trump orchestrated a scheme before the 2016 election to pay off an adult film actress to keep her quiet about a sexual liaison with him years earlier, and then created a false paper trail to hide the true purpose and source of the payment. The court will need to find 11 more panelists to sit in judgment of Trump, which will mean more chances for jurors to opine on the pugilistic politician. Merchan has ordered that the names of the prospective jurors remain confidential, although the prosecutors and defense lawyers are made aware of their name. Trump stirs the pot. He speaks his mind, said one potential juror, a woman who works at a senior care facility. You can't judge him because he speaks his mind. Pressed by Trump lawyer Todd Blanche on what she thought of Trump's outspoken nature, she laughed and said, come on, what can you say about that? If I told you all the time what I thought about people, I want to say some things to people, but my mama said to be nice. So, 11 more, many potential jurors who made it through the initial screening insisted that they could be fair, and some of them openly resisted stating what their political views were, despite being pressed repeatedly by attorneys. Bob, would you like to start?
Yes. I mean, in part, Joe, I'm thinking about the conversations we've had, and I just want to draw a comparison between Donald Trump and how he views public service and the manipulation of his office, the abuse of power, versus what we've just heard from the mayor. And I'd be remiss if I didn't just draw attention to this. You were at an amazing concert doing, you know, bebopping along, finished around 11:30 last night. At 1 o'clock, you were out with the police department dealing with the shooting of a police officer. And you were up all night working that and working with the family. And I just, it just, to me, I think we need to remind ourselves how hardworking, dedicated, and important public service is. Getting to the trial, I'm not at all surprised, Joe, at you know, the first day, and we had this conversation a little bit earlier. First day of jury selection was sort of thinning the herd, and we're starting to see a much more fast-paced sitting of the jury. It's important for all of us to watch this process because we take the judicial system and our legal system for granted, not, I think, completely appreciating the elegance and fairness of our judicial proceedings. This idea of a jury pool of our peers, and it's something that we all need to understand. It's all something that we need to protect. What I also appreciate, and I think we should talk a little bit more about, is so far I'm really impressed with the judge and his willingness to step between the bad behavior of Donald Trump and the judge's demand to protect the process, the sanctity of the jury pool, and that shouldn't get lost in this whole conversation. This is an incredibly important time in American history, and it gets lost in the continued perverse carnival of Donald Trump, and we can't lose track of what's really important. But we also can't lose track of the fact that while despite what Trump says and does, public service is so very, very important, and there's so many people pouring their hearts and lives into it.
Yeah, so I would agree that Judge Marchant is impressive. He has stuck to his plan to pursue a pretty speedy process, and he already sent a signal to Donald Trump and the defense team that Trump can't simply mutter or attempt to intervene or articulate opposition in this process. And I would expect at some point, since I believe Trump can't control himself really, that he will be escorted out of court, set up in a separate room to watch the proceedings on TV for a while, because he's required in a criminal trial to attend the actual hearing and to listen to the exchanges between the legal teams and witnesses, but he's not allowed to interrupt and intervene. And since he's likely to do that anyways, because that's his pattern, he'll be probably sent out of the space into a separate space to where he can mutter all he wants to or shout or whatever he likes to do, but he cannot interrupt directly what the proceedings look like. So it will be interesting to sort of figure out what kind of disciplinary action this judge will take, because I'm sure that is one of the main things he's planning out at this point, what to do, because it can only, we have to anticipate some misbehavior from Trump.
Mike?
Yeah, you mean some courtrooms have cry rooms, like churches may have, where somebody with a baby could move into
something
during
like
mass
that, you
or
know,
something
holding
like
that. Yeah, right. Space, you know, with the TV.
So he can go in there and cry while he likes.
Yeah, something but, like that.
Right. That's pretty good. I think that just the fact that this trial is taking place is a big win for the criminal justice system, that it's happening. And the speed by which they're picking the jury, I think it's really important. You know, Trump always tries to, you know, we've talked about this, you know, forever about how Trump uses delays in the court process to basically beat the system. Well, when you hear a right to a speedy and fair trial, we're entitled to it as a society, too. And we're not entitled to endless delays. And the fact that this is going to happen and he's going to be held accountable and have to answer for these allegations that have been made against him is really a big victory. I'll be curious when it comes out, when the testimony starts to happen, will the focus be on the actual testimony? Will they be the prurient details of the relationships that he had with these women, allegedly? Will they be Trump's walking out and making his comments in the hallway before the microphone? I don't know how it's going to play out, and I'm fascinated by the process. And then once all this begins to roll out, what will the impact be on Trump's own position? Will he be able to exploit it like he did every other time he's appeared in court and put out more fundraising emails, et cetera? Or will the tide begin to change and people will begin to be reminded of what Donald Trump really is?
Well, I think focusing on the jury, you know, we've already become cynical of judges, and there have been accusations of judges acting politically, which really undermines the confidence that this country has in our judicial system, which is unfortunate. And I think the fact that it's been politicized is incredibly unfortunate. But to criticize jurors, I think, is first of all, the Code of Professional Ethics says that lawyers and judges can't criticize jurors. You may disagree with the conclusion that they reached, but to criticize them is problematic. And I think, you know, you can disagree with Donald Trump politically and still be a fair and impartial juror. Yeah. And if we don't think that, then woe to us, because that is what our judicial system is based on. Mm. You listen to the facts, you listen to the evidence, and you follow the law. That's what we ask jurors to do. And whether they like the defendant or not, it does not enter into it. And, you know, I sit here, people are going to write you about this. I could sit as an impartial juror at this trial. I could listen to the evidence and follow the law. And that's what we ask jurors to do. And I'm fearful that as this plays out, Donald Trump will not be able to stop himself from attacking jurors personally. And that's an unfortunate position for these jurors to be in. They're giving up of their time and sitting on this trial, you know, who knows how long it's going to take. And so we have to uphold, to me, the sanctity of the jury and be very mindful that, you know, some of these jurors in their interviews may have said funny things. But we have to uphold that jurors are asked to be impartial. They're not asked to like the defendant or not. They're not asked, you know, what their political views are. They have to listen to the evidence and follow the law.
And I agree completely about the sanctity of the jury. I will note, though, that I've grown increasingly pessimistic about the politicalization of the judiciary, especially the Supreme Court. And I think, you know, they heard the January 6th case. And I just ask this basic question: how can Clarence Thomas sit on a trial of an event that his wife helped format? Okay, so I look at that, and these are the things that make me question the system. And you know, Mike, you raised, you know, one of my hot points about the American judicial system is that it's weighted against the rest of us. Mm-hmm. So if you have money and resources, like Donald Trump has, you are able to manipulate the system and you know, my gut is that if he is elected president, the first thing that he's going to do when he's sworn in is that he is going to pardon himself on from all federal crimes. Mm-hmm. And we need to go to break.
We do indeed. Thank you, Bob. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We'll do so with you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have been talking about the seven jurors who have been picked in the Donald Trump hush money trial so far. On the second day of the trial, today is a day off and we'll return tomorrow. We have letters, and let me go through those and then we'll move on to a new topic. Tom writes, does anyone know if a juror states that they're a MAGA supporter and will never vote to convict? Can they be replaced by an alternate juror, or is that cause for a mistrial?
I think that's why they have alternate jurors. Yeah. Yeah. They have six, actually. So yeah. That can happen up to six times and not interfere with the trial outcome. They sit. I mean, Mayor Sheen, you're an attorney, but they sit there for the whole trial and hear all the evidence and testimony just like a juror, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I haven't practiced law in a really long time.
But none of us are lawyers.
But I think that that what the letter writer is saying is if you say I can't be impartial, then no, you can't sit on the jury. I mean, if you say that out loud, then, right. you can't be. I mean, mm-hmm. I was called for jury duty and, they ask you a bunch of questions. You know, do you know the prosecutor? I did. Do you know the defense attorney? I did. Do you know the judge? I did. Mm-hmm. And so even though I think I could have been an objective, I know I could have been an objective juror, the perception of people on both sides mm-hmm. would have been, well, she's the mayor and she,
she
knows this person. So I think that that's the piece of it that, you have to be mindful of as well.
And the other thing
I would want you on my jury.
Yes. You sound like a great juror, actually. So one thing I would be concerned about is if somebody's on this jury trying to make a buck off it, trying to sort of
write
do
the
interviews,
book.
A book, mm-hmm. Insights,
It reminds me of
the I so scuttled. American, though. I'm okay with that.
It's entrepreneurial. Remember the juror, the grand jury foreman in Georgia?
Georgia.
The woman who mm-hmm. spoke openly in the, mm-hmm. To the New York Times long before the indictments were handed down. I mean, I think that also undermines people's
it
trust
does.
In
you
the
can't,
process.
Yeah. You can't possibly begin to do, it's fine. Like yesterday, I think they interviewed a juror who was not selected and asked her about her process and her experience, which was very interesting, I thought. Yeah. But, if you do some sort of, texting out while you're on the jury, sharing. When we see that kind of stuff coming out, we got to make sure we clamp down and identify who this juror might be. I mean, this is likely to happen, I think. I wouldn't be surprised, let's say.
I would imagine this is a jury that's going to be sequestered. And
it's not, actually, I think. Is that right?
I think it'll end up that way.
It may have to. Yeah.
Barbara writes, we, the people, need to know the outcome of all four cases before we vote for president in a perfect world. Do we? Well, I mean, and I say this, I mean, let's just put the politics aside.
We don't have enough evidence.
Well, right. So there's that tact, right? I mean, there's certainly that path to go down. But there's also that there's a lot of other people who are running who may have whatever skeletons that aren't going to go to a trial, and we vote on what we know about them and what we think. And in both of these cases, these two men have served 4 years as president of the United States. So you have quite a bit to go on. I don't know if you need necessarily the outcome of all four cases.
And I think there are people who he could be found guilty in all four cases and they'd still vote for him as president. I mean, this is what democracy has, as it has played out, looks like. And I think that's where, education and to, back to the League of Women Voters. How do you determine whether the news that you're getting is from a source that you can trust or that it's coming from the campaign or coming from a Russian bot, So I think that's the important thing. But there are people who are going to vote for Donald Trump. They want him to be our president. even if he has committed high crimes and misdemeanors.
Except where I think the letter writer is correct is that there is an important proportion of people who would think and act differently given evidence and a conviction. And this is where I get crazed about a couple things. One is that I thought the Justice Department moved particularly slowly at the beginning, and that I fault mm-hmm. Garland on. Mm-hmm. I think that this was these court cases should have been taken up a year to 18 months ago. It didn't happen. But then I get frustrated because I look at something like the Supreme Court stepping in as slowly as possible, and sort of kicking the question of presidential immunity to make it to almost ensure that we the people are not able to see a lot of the evidence. I mean, it's hard not to look at this and see a conspiracy.
Well, the main part also is if you're privileged, if you have a lot of money, if you have connections, you can delay a lot. And this is what's happened. And then, there are various other considerations where judges or decisions are made to with the emphasis to come across as neutral, as reliable, and that added extra time to Trump and his defense team to obfuscate and confuse and ask for additional reviews. And this entire process that is not available to all of us, but only certain people, makes it appear that it benefits the rich and wealthy and famous.
Well, sure, and Vera, I mean, it's like, I mean, what are we going to do? I mean, a roundtable listener is going to do a fund drive to buy a Winnebago to try to get Clarence Thomas to listen to our side?
Yeah.
You know, and this is where I do look at the Supreme Court and what I perceive to be public corruption in ways that I've never thought about the court before.
Yeah.
I mean, it's impossible for me not to look at Alito and Thomas and say the gifts that they have taken aren't influencing their decisions.
On that subject, Mary writes, "Let's be consistent. If we agree with the mayor's comments about her and a juror's ability to listen to the facts and apply the laws, can we not also say that Justice Thomas can do the same in the January 6th case?"
There's another issue there, though. I mean, part of our whole legal system is based on the, appreciation of the objectivity of the jurist. And if there's an apparent, if it appears that there may be a conflict of interest, you just step aside and you bring somebody else in. And you defer from being engaged in that because you don't want to undermine the trust people have in this system. If you stay there after your stated positions, after your own family connections in this case are all outed, it makes questions that just further undermine the judicial system.
Well, the rules are very clear.
Yeah.
And every other level. because I then gave the example of why I didn't sit on a jury because of the appearance that I knew the prosecutor and I knew the judge. And so that had an appearance that I might not be able to be objective. If you are a judge and you are hearing a case that involves actions that your spouse took, I can't imagine a judge that would not recuse themselves.
Yeah.
That is what they are supposed to do.
And by not recusing himself, I think Clarence Thomas is being extraordinarily arrogant and undermines, in the process of that, undermines our trust, your trust, Bob, and everybody else's in the Supreme Court.
And he may very well be able to be objective. I don't know. It's
exactly.
His spouse.
I don't know, but yes.
But it undermines, most of us say, well, I don't think I could be objective. I'm going to decide, and this is something that my spouse did. I think the reasonable person would say, you can recuse yourself, There are other justices. Let them hear the case.
I mean, the main situation is also we know that he's having conversations with his wife at home about various cases. I mean, they're not going to not speak to each other. right? They're having conversations about these cases.
That's a presumption. I mean, it's a very logical probably safe presumption. But
that you have some conversation about it.
But if he put a wall up and said, we're not going to talk about that, and I'm going to be objective, that is not enough.
It's not believable.
Undermining your trust.
That's right. That's right. It's not believable. And therefore, he should have recused himself. And he's not. And so from the top down, he's weakening the reputation and undermining the reputation of the judicial system.
The whole
system.
Yeah.
And again, I think it drives home, you know, linking the two, it drives home the influence of money in power now into the court system.
Yeah.
Right. Especially with the revelations that have come out in the last year about how he's been, you know, recipient of very generous gifts from very wealthy conservative donors. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Barbara, who says, Trump and his lawyers keep claiming that the gag order imposed on him is against his First Amendment rights. Since when are threats considered a right? Then we go to Dennis.
But Joe, one second. This is the problem, though. You know, how does society deal with a bully with the resources that he has? Mm-hmm.
A big challenge. I think it's also a challenge. This trial will underscore it again. It's a challenge for the conventional and, you know, the legitimate news media on how to cover this. What is the story here? Is it whether this man falsified business records and now he has to pay the price? Or what is the story? You know, and how the media covers this is going to define how people see it to some degree.
And I think the courts have deferred too much to Donald Trump. I think that there are actions that he's taken in other trials where if it was me or you, we would have done some contempt of court time. And he seems to get a continued deference from the courts that the rest of us wouldn't, which means that already the system is imbalanced.
Dennis writes, have you heard of any political jurors saying they don't want to serve because they fear for their safety? Some jurors have said that.
Yes.
That they're concerned and don't want to be brought into the circus.
And we're concerned now already. We know about the first seven jurors that have been seated. We know a bit about them, you know, married, unmarried, you know, women,
profession.
You know, if somebody's out for a few weeks from their job, it's pretty quickly identifiable who that is within your own, you know, circles. And so it's not impossible to identify these jurors, at least some of them, I think. So it is a reasonable concern for jurors to be worried about potential consequences, because we've seen that in other states where people have been approached or threatened, or even poll workers, as we know, have been
intimidated,
their reputations destroyed, and so on. So I think it's a reasonable concern to express.
All right, let's move on to other topics for this Wednesday morning in our program. I do want to talk about Ukraine aid. I want to talk about...
We're all like,
Grumble, 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 grumble. Well,
the hummingbirds are coming, Joe.
Yeah, the hummingbirds are coming. And when they get here, there may or may not be a different Speaker of the House in Congress. We don't know. It seems like this is just the gift that keeps on giving. We keep on talking about this. Bob, were you here last week when I said the words, this just seems to be, you know, we talked about this before, we're going to talk about it again. Hey, guess what? We're going to talk about it again. There was a meeting that took place between Mike Johnson and Donald Trump, and the speaker did all the things a speaker needs to do to suck up to a former president of the United States. And he did all of that stuff and kissed the ring and other things. And then we thought, oh, well, now this is going to be better. This will be, you know, he has the endorsement of the person who seems to be holding the strings on Congress. And now the Republican Speaker's strategy for moving foreign aid measures for Israel and Ukraine through the House has outraged many in his own party, increasing calls for his ouster. Mm-hmm. He encountered stiff resistance from Republicans as they embarked on a complicated and politically perilous strategy to push legislation through the House to send aid to Israel and Ukraine, all while beating back a threat to his own job. May I just insert for a moment of how complicated and politically perilous is it to decide to give aid to Israel and Ukraine at this point?
It shouldn't be complicated at all. I think this is part of the conundrum that we're in right now is how did the GOP get to a point where they would back Putin versus Ukraine? I mean, the Russians were bombing Ukrainian cities last night. I mean it's a completely foreign concept to me.
But the relationship between Trump and Putin it has always been one of, to me, total complicity. And I mean, just observing it, what was that conversation? You know,
right.
So I think that but it is shocking that the Republican Party and that you would have Republicans who you would otherwise think would be, in unison saying, of course we have to provide aid to Ukraine. The mayor of Bucha was in Albany about a week ago. We had a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. I will be traveling to Bucha in June, and they're doing a groundbreaking for a hospital there. And these are people who were attacked in a war and an aggression that will not stop. Have we learned nothing from history? Yeah. This aggression must be stopped.
And if you don't...
As a dude would say, this aggression will not abide, right?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, if you don't, this isn't going to be ongoing. It will be maybe there's a stop to this particular attack, but then is a Baltic state next? What are the consequences if we don't stand up to one of the most vicious attackers of a society in Central Europe?
And in Bucha, that is where horrific war crimes
Absolutely.
Were committed.
Absolutely.
Civilians were slaughtered. The mayor had to hide in various basements because the Russian army was looking for him because they were going to kill him. And so
people who are not supporting our aid to Ukraine are not hearing any of that. What they're hearing is, I was in North Carolina a couple weeks ago, and on the TV in the hotel, they had an ad for a Congress race, and they said, and it was a Republican who was running against a Democrat. I don't know who was in office, but they were saying, the Democrat wants to send your money to a war across the world instead of using it to fight crime here in America. I mean, that is the way they look at it. They don't see it. They just don't see it.
And you're thinking to yourself, yeah, okay, that sounds good.
Yeah. I mean, but that's all they're hearing. I mean, that's the narrative. And it's so narrow. It's all about not knowing history. It's all about not knowing the world.
But there's a couple important things from last week, though, Joe, that we need to, at the end of the week, Gallagher retires, leaving, I think, a one-vote majority.
Yes.
The other point is Jared Moskowitz's comment, which is being parroted, and if you're picking it up, the Democrats are already coming out and flagging that they will not support the Marjorie Taylor Greene's motion to vacate.
Yes.
Yep. So there's a really interesting, some interesting subcurrents that have occurred in the past week that I think really change the dynamic of what's going on. Now, whether Johnson is astute enough in order to take advantage of that or not, I'm not sure. But he's getting flagged in ways that certainly McCarthy wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Johnson, who has agonized for months over whether and how to advance aid to Ukraine that many in his party bitterly oppose, has settled on a multi-part plan that requires everything to go right for him this week to prevail.
Well, that might be the challenge, right? Because he's chopping up legislation. He's trying to push through bits and parts. He has to deal with Moscow Marjorie, who now has, an ally. And I mean, it's so complicated. Yeah, it's so crazy. And he cannot survive unless he gets the Democratic support. But they're waiting to see what the pieces look like for Ukraine aid, separate from Israel aid, separate from, you know, various other bits and pieces that looked like the former, I think very close to the former Senate bill that was supported,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of a crazy game of putting the puzzle back together, and it is very complicated. And I'm not convinced he's our speaker, not our speaker, their speaker, he's as politically savvy as he needs to be.
But all he has to do is read any of the many political analyses that have come out overnight showing that Hakeem Jeffries is going to let just enough Democrats support him. I mean, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? I don't think it takes a deep analysis to know that.
That is true. That is true. But how will his conference reply to this? You know, that is how many votes will go.
If he loses 12 votes, Jeffries will let 13 go. If he loses 20 votes, Jeffries will let 21 go.
You seem to be confident. I'm not so sure.
It has to come up to a vote, though.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
But it also shows, I think, that the GOP's inability to govern. And it's coming at just an amazing time. I mean, this is, if I'm a GOP strategist, I'm thinking this is the absolute worst time to be reminding the voters that we don't know what the hell we're doing. And you know, they pushed Humpty Dumpty off the wall once, and they were kind of able to put it back in sort of a weird shape after, you know, screwing up all of the multiple votes. There is nobody in that caucus that it would be able to pull that caucus together. So if they push Johnson off the ledge right now, it will cost them.
To stop.
This is all of our right. Like, this is the internal politics of this. Those who are supporting this dysfunctional Republican Party would also say that we are the leader of the free world. And we are not.
No, we're not.
No, we are not demonstrating what the leader of the free world does when an ally is attacked and when people's lives are on the line and the rest of the world is watching. What does this do and say about us as a nation that is admired around the world? And yet we are disassembling it before our eyes. And there are those that are saying, keep going. Keep doing it, and that are supporting this complete dysfunction. Government needs to govern, and we are seeing this lack of activity, and we have to connect it. You know, I think Mike, you said to the people, to these people are being harmed.
We have to pause there. We'll take a break. We'll continue on the other side, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Final go-around for our panel this morning on this Wednesday morning. It's the 17th of April, 34 minutes past 10 o'clock. Hope you are all doing well. I want to ask Vera a question because we were
warm up for Friday.
Don't worry. Okay. Don't worry. It's certainly in your wheelhouse, and it certainly is something that it came out of yesterday's conversation, which I thought was an interesting one because there was an article in I believe it was the Washington Post, and you could prove me wrong, but I think it was the Washington Post, that talked about Ukraine watching the assistance that was given Israel during the weekend attack and then feeling very, very alone as this is happening. And all the while this fight going on in the U.S. Congress as to furthering aid to Ukraine. So given your background, I'm especially curious as to what you make of that and how, I mean, how they obviously perceive it, but how we should perceive it.
Well, I mean, it does make sense that Ukraine is feeling, you know, increasingly abandoned, I think, by the United States. Initially, the support was very strong. It was united. It was clearly in favor of defending Ukraine from a vicious Russian attack, but we have continued attacks on Ukraine. Last night, as Bob mentioned, there was this unbelievable bombing of civilians and murdering of civilians as they walk on the street. And the Ukrainian situation is they're out of certain parts of artillery, out of certain, you know, they don't have air defenses. We have never really been forthcoming in Europe and the United States to give them all of the weapons they needed. We have been very slow in, you know, the Ukrainians report what they need, and then it takes months and months and months to supply them. And now what the Ukrainians are watching is an increasing lack of enthusiasm to defend them against the Russian attack. In the United States, the conversations are confusing. Republicans seem to be less and less engaged or even pro-Russian, or suggest that Ukrainians should just negotiate with the attacker without being in a position of, you know, strength at this point. It is very confusing, that message. Ukrainians thought of themselves as being strongly allied with the United States, strongly allied with the Europeans, and they feel increasingly less verbally supported and increasingly less in terms supported in terms of receiving weapons and basic equipment like artillery shells that they need to defend themselves. So this is shocking, in particular when at the same time there are growing warnings worldwide to the Israeli government to reflect on the level of aggression and violence they show towards Palestinian communities, that they should try and get the remaining hostages out and pursue a ceasefire arrangement and come up with a way to end this war on Gaza, irrespective of how they will continue attacking and eliminating Hamas. But here we are. The Iranians send millions of dollars worth of weaponry, you know, drone attacks and missiles that are basically all shot down. It's a complete waste of money. It's a big show. It's not effective. But the United States, despite all its warnings and all its criticism of Israeli politics, immediately comes to Israel's support, right? So this is sort of a very interesting message to the Ukrainians. They're like, okay, so you critique Israel, you wanted to get the hostages out and pursue a ceasefire. We are doing everything we can to collaborate with the United States, with the Europeans, but we're increasingly less supported. So this is a message that shows disinterest among the United States for the Ukrainian situation, whereas Israel is front and center, despite continuous warnings. So I would be confused, too, if I was sitting in the government in Ukraine and I'd be looking for strong allies. And, of course, Putin is celebrating the fact that, you know, the United States is so focused on policies in Israel and the Palestinians situation. I don't know, Bob, what you think.
I think that the big loser in the weekend was the Palestinian people,
yeah,
because the sort of sympathy and support that they were starting to receive, and you know, I've been a supporter of Israel, but at the same time, I've really felt that Netanyahu and his government have gone too far. But with the Iranian attack, and it's interesting how the Iranian attack is now being spun as symbolic. It wasn't symbolic. It was 300 missiles and drones being launched against their population.
Missiles, ballistic missiles.
Ballistic missiles. Now, we know they didn't go anywhere, really.
Well, they were fired. They were shot down. Yep. But, I mean, they were going where they were supposed to go. And if any one of those had hit, you would have talked about, huge potential casualties. And what gets lost, though, is that there's still, you know, there still isn't a plan for ceasefire or for pulling out of Gaza. the Ukrainians, though, you know, they have the right to feel abandoned. We are abandoning them right now.
Yep.
They need these supplies. They need these munitions. They need to be able to combat the fact that Iran and North Korea and China are supplying Russia. That Russia continues to rebuild their military, and I can guarantee the people who are listening that Putin is not going to stop with Ukraine.
Oh, no.
No, but what will happen if Congress approves the funding and then a Democrat, Biden, is reelected? What will that change? I mean, that gives Putin a different situation than holding out for Trump to win. I mean, don't you think that's what's going on here? He's exploiting
if Biden is reelected and the Democrats are stronger, I think the Ukrainians feel supported again.
Right.
But if, you know, Putin is holding out, he's trying to sort of attack, and he's getting his weaponry from the North Koreans and from the Iranians, and, you know. But here's the thing. What is Israel's plan in the region? Are we trying to really pursue now a regional war? Is this where we're going? We're going to now reflect on how to, you know, is Netanyahu is he really trying to expand this war so he stays longer in power? I mean, inside Israel, there's a lot of protests, a lot of movement. People really, really want the remaining, those who are still alive, or even the bodies of the hostages out. I mean, I understand that. I would want that too. My family members, if they were in there, I would want to know. I want this to end. It's horrible torture. We also need a ceasefire so that the Palestinian people won't be slaughtered. Are we at 33,000 people in Gaza now?
Yeah, but also, if I could, one other point that I think we can't lose in this conversation is the brilliance of the diplomatic action that was able to put a coalition together to help take down that attack.
Yep.
Think about it. It wasn't just the United States and Israel.
UK, yeah.
It was the UK. It was France. It was also countries in the Middle East. I mean, and this is where, you know, this gets lost in this in this conversation.
Right. I mean, you know, Anthony Blinken, our State Department have shown such an amazing leadership through a very, very tough time.
And the
that doesn't happen under a Trump administration.
No.
There is no talent in his foreign
And when you think
advisors.
About it, too, Iran's plan is not really working out. If the Israelis hold and don't counterattack and do crazy things now, Arab leaders have not embraced the propaganda that comes out of Iran. They're not impressed. They're saying this is a disaster for all of us if we have a regional war. They don't want it. It can only benefit Iran to some extent, the Iranian regime to some extent.
Russia.
They can, well, clearly Russia. But in the region, I meant, it's only beneficial to a deeply repressive regime potentially in Iran. So this is catastrophic if the Israelis pursue an expansion of this war for all of us, except for maybe the Russians.
That was as knowledgeable and as complete an answer as I was hoping it would be. So thank you very much. It was something we were exploring yesterday, and I didn't feel that we got to it fully. So thank you. Just about 3 or 4 minutes left with our panel, and the mayor is here, and I would like to ask the question about the College of St. Rose. My alma mater is closing next month. I think most people in the region know that. This century-old institution is shutting its doors, and it's going to be, I just assume that the next month and a half is going to be very traumatizing and sad for all of us who, as a faculty member, as an alum, and as just a fan of the great colleges that we have in the city of Albany. So enter Touro University and the news in the Times Union about schools that the schools have been in discussion and a possible affiliation that could keep Albany the Albany College open in some form. And Touro University is a New York City-based school and said it is exploring an affiliation within the College of St. Rose, a last-ditch effort that could potentially keep the 104-year-old college campus open in some form. The exact parameters of the potential deal were unclear on Monday. The president of the university, Dr. Alan Kadish, confirmed the school had some preliminary exploratory discussions with St. Rose. They did not provide further details. They did say that they had taken a tour of the campus. However, no plans are in place, and it's still uncertain what, if any, type of partnership would be finalized. What do you know, Mayor?
Well, look, I know that if an affiliation were easy, it would have happened, and that the tremendous amount of debt that the College of St. Rose is carrying is incredibly challenging and makes it problematic for anyone to come in and acquire the campus or have an affiliation. And so I did reach out to one of the provosts at Touro. She is somebody who used to be at Albany Law School, so she's somebody that I know, to just say, you know, I want to be as helpful as I can. If this is a possibility, you know, please don't hesitate to reach out and help us to understand what would it take for this to happen, because I think all of us would love to see a continuation of higher education on that campus in some way, shape, or form, even if it is smaller than what is currently there. And so we will see.
In the article in the Times Union, there was also an indication that other schools have looked into this as well and have been in talks. And I'm just curious as to how involved do you get into that? Because obviously it's a huge deal for the city, but yet.
Well, and again, it's a challenging position for a mayor to be in, because we don't own the campus and we can't control what is going to happen next with respect to the decisions that the bondholders are going to make. And so I'm hopeful that the bondholders are reasonable and rational and recognize that, 100 cents on the dollar is not necessarily realistic, given that we have colleges closing all over the country, and so these small, particularly small liberal arts colleges, small private colleges, are in a really challenging environment, and we've got to ensure that there is an ability to reuse this property in a responsible, reasonable, rational way. And it's important to understand this market and what it will take to redevelop the buildings on that campus. I think the housing's a little bit easier, but to redevelop and reimagine this campus is going to be a lift. It's doable, but it's going to be a lift, and it is going to require, I think, that the bondholders recognize that sitting on this is not going to be the right answer for them.
But that indicates to me, and maybe I'm wrong, but that indicates to me that this is going to be, or could be potentially, if that ideology maintains, that it will be a long time before it's settled.
Well, I will say the real estate market is still very, very strong. And so there is a lot happening in this region. You have a new quantum computer at RPI. You have the AI investments that are happening at UAlbany. That is going to require businesses who need that computing power. And so there is an opportunity here. And I think it's important that we have a realistic understanding, though, of what that opportunity is. And so that is why I'm always an optimist, Joe. So we're going to continue to have those conversations and to make sure that we're doing all that we can to market this in a way that it will be successful.
I know that you have to go, but how do you see the city and the many faculty alum kind of mourning the loss over the next several weeks and months?
You know, it's got to be incredibly hard. When you think about, I'm an alum of Albany Law School, and law schools went through a really, really rough patch after the recession. And there was a point in time that Albany Law School had to look very seriously at an affiliation. We told our alum about it. We were open and public about what was happening. And ultimately, we were able to right the ship and get on firmer ground and move forward. And admissions started to go up and more people started applying and going back to law school. If you hate lawyers, you know, that might be bad news for you. But, but you know, we saw that turnaround. But, it was, so I had that feeling. It didn't come to fruition. So the fact that it has come to fruition, it's heartbreaking. And, you know, we've reached out to faculty. We've held job fairs. Mm-hmm. We've done personal phone calls to some folks to say, hey, you know, here are opportunities that exist in the city. I know the county has done the same thing because we want to ensure that those who want to stay and stay in Albany, that they have a place to land.
How would you characterize the relationship with the current administration of the college?
Well, I just met with the president. I'm losing sense of time. I can't remember whether it was this week or last week. But I did meet with the president, and she updated me on what was happening and what their plans are. And they do intend to maintain the campus through the end of the calendar year. So, you know, we're working with them on what that looks like, and they've committed to, you know, neighbors are worried about, is the grass going to become overgrown? And she has assured me, of course, she and the board recognize that this is in a neighborhood, that they need to maintain it.
President of the college. All right. You have to go. I'm going to hold the rest of our class for a few more moments to the top of the hour. I can't thank you enough for being here. It's always a great pleasure, and I hope to see you very soon.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Be well. Thank you, Mayor.
Take care.
Appreciate it. All right. Thank you. It's always very handy to have a mayor on hand. Let's talk about
a lot of topics today.
Yes, a lot of topics that fit right into that skill set, doesn't it? So, final topic for us, pro-Palestinian protests could foreshadow a summer of upheaval. We're seeing this throughout the country. We're seeing this throughout the globe. But certainly for Democratic candidates and throughout this country, we saw it. There's a picture in the Washington Post today of demonstrators in Oakland, California, and police trying to allow traffic to continue. There are traffic snarling pro-Palestinian demonstrations in U.S. cities on Monday, which could foreshadow a potentially volatile summer of protests, creating a challenge for President Biden and sparking debate over whether some activist tactics threaten to undermine public support for their movement. Demonstrators shut down major thoroughfares for hours in cities, including San Francisco and New York, as part of a global campaign to raise awareness about Israel's war in Gaza on U.S. Tax Day. In Chicago and Seattle, protesters blocked the entrance to international airports, forcing travelers and flight crews to walk to airline terminals or potentially miss their flights. In San Francisco, police had to use welding equipment to free demonstrators from the Bay Bridge after they had locked themselves together with pipes. That's a commitment.
It's a tactic that we've seen for a long time. That's what the INF World Bank protesters used back in 2000.
Oh, in Seattle, yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you think this will affect our
summer?
Yeah, affect our summer, absolutely, Mike. Affect our summer, but also affect the policies, right. The policies of the Biden administration, as well as the overall response to the many issues that we discussed a few moments ago.
I think the pro-Palestinian movement has misread the population. If you think about the timing right after Iran launches an attack on Israel, and then taking their movement into, quote, the streets, but in order to block access for just common people trying to get to work and to do their business, that is not a winner in my book. It creates, I think, it moves people from even a neutral position to a, I really don't like you, and therefore I'm not going to like your position.
Yeah, it can backfire terribly. And it's, you know, if we look back at history, I mean, think of 1968. That's how Richard Nixon benefited from the protests. And it was a terrible time of upheaval, of course. It was, you know, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Martin Luther King was assassinated. You had the upheaval of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago that year. And the streets were full of protests. And what did it do? It really, I think, swayed people in the middle or people on the edge towards Nixon, and that's how we got Nixon. And it doesn't have the outcome that people, I think, legitimately and, you know, may have a very honest attempt to, you know, change U.S. policy to factor in more the fate of the Palestinian people. I mean, who could disagree with that? Although some do, but it's going to backfire, I'm afraid.
So I'm not convinced. I agree with the two of you. I just recall my time in Germany as a younger person and the anti-nuclear protests and the aggression there and the protests against the American bases there and weapons deliveries. So I think, of course, it can be quickly overtaken by if we have concerns about levels of violence, you know, that is a major concern. But in terms of awareness raising and making people pay attention and shaping opinions among younger voters, this can be effective. I think this is not something that I would dismiss out of hand as necessarily turning into a problem. I think this, I mean, it could be a serious challenge to the Biden administration, but the Biden administration has already adjusted quite a bit and is continuing to do so to undercut this kind of movement. And I think we will have to wait and see. I think it's a very interesting moment.
It certainly is. We got to a lot of big stuff today. My thanks to all of you for being here. Mike, Vera, Bob, thanks again to Mayor Sheehan. We'll be back right after this.